All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a packed show for you today. It's just two segments, but it's really packed, believe me, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with progressive film critic Ed Rampell about the Progies, and those are the Progressive Awards for the most progressive films out in the previous year. And if you don't know what the Progies are, you will by the time we're done with this segment, all right? It's going to be a really interesting one. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be welcoming back to the show Raymond Latta. And Raymond has just recently written an article about the new developments in the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba. And I had a chance to talk with Raymond about that a little bit earlier this week. And so we're just going to jump right into the interview I did with him on the U.S. and Cuba. What the hell is going on? On December 17th, the United States and Cuba announced the restoration of full diplomatic relations. President Obama also announced that the U.S. will ease restrictions on travel, on the amount of cash that can be sent to individuals in Cuba, and on the export of telecommunications equipment and on certain banking activity. This is the beginning of an article by Raymond Latta. Raymond's a writer for Revolution Newspaper and an advocate of the work of Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this article is something that really digs into just what the hell is going on with this situation in Cuba. And Raymond's joining us to talk about it today. Raymond, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Michael. It's a very important question at this time to be getting into.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump into it. The title of your article is The Recolonization in the Name of Normalization, Behind the Reestablishment of U.S.-Cuba Diplomatic Relations. What's your overall take on this? I mean, you talk about recolonization in the name of normalization. What are you talking about here?
Yeah. Well, the basic thesis of the article is that there is, obviously, a big shift in the U.S. imperialist stance towards Cuba. And this is taking the form of the full restoration of diplomatic relations, along with some of the economic relations that are being opened up that you mentioned in setting up the interview here. Now, what I'm arguing is that the terms of normalization are not in the interests of the Cuban people. I'm basically making two points about this in terms of an overview. One, that the U.S. has no right, has had no right, and has no right to economically punish and diplomatically isolate Cuba, and all of what it's done in terms of military threats, invasions, assassination attempts, all of what it's done, you know, since the Cuban Revolution in 1959. This is completely unjust, unacceptable, and immoral. So that, on the one hand. On the other, the terms of normalization that are being dictated by the United States are terms that are really aimed at two things. One, opening Cuba up to exploitation by U.S. capital, and two, it's a strategic move by U.S. imperialism as part of a larger calculation to reassert its influence, its strength, and its hegemony in the Western Hemisphere. So that's essentially what I'm saying here, that the U.S. has had no right and has no right to diplomatically and economically isolate and punish Cuba. But this normalization is not what it's being heralded as in the media here, and even by, you know, some leftists and progressives, which is that somehow Obama has made a bold and brave break with past policy, and this represents something that's very good for the Cuban people. No, this is something that is driven by U.S. strategic and economic interest. Mm-hmm. That's the basic argument, the basic point that I'm making and that I unfold in the article.
And we'll get into that in just a little bit, but I wanted you to go back a minute to this point about what the U.S. relationship with Cuba has been, including in the very beginning. Because, you know, as I was reading your piece, I kept thinking, you know, the vast majority of the people alive in this country anyway, and maybe in the world, don't have any idea about what the history of the relationship between U.S. and Cuba is or has been. So can you dig into that? Because you present a very compelling and disgusting picture as well about what actually that relationship had been before the Cuban Revolution.
Yeah. For more than 100 years, the United States has imposed incredible suffering and misery on the Cuban people. I mean, let's step back. Historically, in the 19th century, the late 19th century, the Cuban people rose up in a national independent struggle. Cuba had been a colony of Spain. And in the late 1800s, as I said, there was this fierce liberation struggle, a rebellion against Spanish colonial rule. And in 1898, the U.S. moved to take advantage of this struggle. And there was what was called the Spanish-American War. The U.S. imperialists saw an opening, an opportunity to maneuver, to take advantage of this independence struggle to bring Cuba under its wing and under its control. And this is what the United States did. There was the famous explosion that took place on the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor, and this has now been shown to have been a planned explosion as a pretext to get the U.S. population all fired up and whipped up to support U.S. military activity in Cuba. And in 1898, the U.S. was able to impose terms on the Spaniards, you know, who were, as I said, being assaulted by the Cuban people in their battle for independence. And the U.S. was able to maneuver to bring Cuba under its control, taking advantage, as I said, of that independence struggle. And what it did is it imposed, through treaty arrangements, ways and means by which it would dictate its power over the Cuban economy and Cuban society. One of the key elements of this was what was called the Platt Amendment. Your listeners may not have heard of that, P-L-A-T-T. This was an amendment that was passed by the U.S. Congress, and it gave the U.S. the right to interfere in the affairs, the internal affairs of Cuba. And this was actually incorporated in the new Cuban Constitution. And as a result of this, the U.S. landed Marines in Cuba four times in the early 1900s. And also established its military colony, Guantanamo, the Guantanamo naval base, which is now, as we know, a Guantanamo torture and concentration camp serving the interest of U.S. imperialism. So the U.S. was able to impose indirect control over Cuba through these treaty provisions, through its economic penetration and economic and political power. And in the 1898 Spanish-American War, and the outcome of that, U.S. directly annexed Puerto Rico, the Philippines, Hawaii, and Guam. In the case of Cuba, it was formally independent, but as I said, the U.S. was running the show economically, politically, and militarily, and it gave backing and support, financial and military, to a whole string of corrupt dictators that were operating and serving in the interests of U.S. imperialism. One of the things I do in the article is I give some data, kind of a thumbnail sketch of the extent to which the U.S. controlled this economy. 80% of the utilities, 90% of the mines, nickel mining in Cuba, 100% of the oil refineries, 90% of the cattle ranches, and 40% of sugar production was controlled by U.S. capital. And for sugar plantation workers, by the way, I had been to Cuba in 1970. I spoke with, you know, older workers at the time. I was very young, but I spoke with some of the older Cuban sugar workers, and they told me what it was like working in the fields, the cruel and oppressive conditions of exploitation, punctuated by periods of unemployment, what they call dead time, tiempo muerte. This was what it was like. And at the same time, Cuba was turned into this den for gambling, for prostitution, real estate speculation. People may have seen The Godfather, the movie with Marlon Brando, and the second installment of The Godfather has coverage. Part of the storyline takes you to Cuba in the 1950s, where the mobster Meyer Lansky had huge investments in hotels. This is what Cuba was like. It was controlled and dominated by the U.S. There were, and this is pretty remarkable for a country of perhaps 9 million people at the time, there were 60,000 to 100,000 prostitutes in Cuba. This was a sex tourism center for U.S. businessmen and travelers. This was the backdrop for the Cuban Revolution of 1959. This was the Cuba that has been extolled and lauded as the society that had been lost to these communist infidels. But this was the reality of Cuban society on the eve of the Cuban Revolution in 1959. And this is the backdrop from the Spanish-American War, the Cuban battle for independence, how the U.S. moved to take advantage of that and was able to thoroughly dominate every facet of Cuban society.
Now, Raymond, one of the things, as you're saying, and I keep thinking too, there was also something else that actually really stood out to me because I was watching a Boardwalk Empire, for instance, again, the repetition of sort of what Cuba was. There were all the bootleggers going down there and all the casinos and all this other stuff. But there was also that the U.S. didn't just do that, but they also propped up a very brutal dictator by the name of Batista during that time as well, right?
Yeah. In this period of the 1950s, now Boardwalk Empire is taking place much earlier. We can go by our gangster films and gangster TV series.
Yeah.
Boardwalk Empire is taking place, right, you know, in the early phase of U.S. domination over Cuba. And, you know, we're talking about the late teens and the 20s, the 1920s into the early 30s. Batista was the ruler who was in power in the 1950s, and he received military backing and economic assistance from the U.S. He himself was heavily invested in some of these gambling operations and also had large land holdings himself. And he was notorious, not just for his corruption, but for his brutality. You know, there was a prison. This is where Castro and other political figures were sent. There was an island where people were sent. It was kind of like a devil's island prison. It was an incredibly repressive society. So you had, you know, all this foreign capital, U.S. capital, that was dominating. You had this casino economy, and you had this brutal exploitation of sugar plantation workers. And, you know, United Fruit owned land in Cuba. This was the notorious U.S. agribusiness firm that dominated lots of agricultural production in the Caribbean and Central America. And then you had this character, Batista, you know, with his armed forces that was imposing this tight-fisted, ironclad rule to prevent the Cuban people from asserting, you know, their rights and their ability to actually take control of society.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Raymond Lada. Raymond's a political economist, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and an advocate of Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism. Well, let's move on with this, because I think that's, you know, it's also very important in terms of understanding all that. It's also very important as a basis for understanding, as you said, this is sort of was the backdrop and the grounding for what emerged as the Cuban Revolution in 1959 and the 1950s. So let's talk about that a little bit. What was that, and what was the response of the U.S. to that?
Well, the Cuban Revolution was led by Fidel Castro, as people know, and it was a movement that had an urban base, and it was a movement that is among intellectuals and progressive professional forces. It had a base among workers, the tobacco workers and sugar workers, and it was a revolution that saw this guerrilla movement in the mountains and in the countryside gather strength and influence. And there was a movement, as I said, corresponding to this in the cities. And in 1959, this revolution led by Castro was able to topple the hated Batista regime, the regime that we were just talking about. And this was a mass uprising. It was a just, it was a popular uprising that overthrew this regime of Batista and also began to move against the vested U.S. economic interests. Shortly after coming to power, there were attempts to negotiate some agreements with the United States, but the U.S. took a very strong position that it was not going to allow its paradise, you know, to slip out of its hands. And Castro led in nationalizing the holdings of many of the U.S. firms, and then began to carry out social programs, literacy and health. So this was what was taking place in the early years of the Cuban Revolution. As I said, it was a mass uprising, and it moved to nationalize, that is, to assert state control over these economic holdings, and it launched certain social programs. But what I go on to emphasize in this article is that Cuba, under Fidel Castro's leadership and this leadership core of the revolution, did not carry out a genuine all-around revolution, that is, a socialist revolution. On the one hand, it did not break the vice grip, the stranglehold of imperialism, of world capitalism, the world capitalist market over the Cuban economy. That is, the Cuban economy was organized around sugar. It was organized around the dominance of a single imperialist power, the United States. 70% of Cuba's trade was with the United States. Sugar was king. all aspects of the economy were subordinate to this, what's called a monoculture, that agriculture was structured around sugar, and the larger economy was structured around the export of sugar. Now, I did mention there were investments in other fields and spheres. There was the gambling, and there was the hotel, there was the real estate, you know, that very parasitic component of the Cuban economy. But at the root and at the core of this economy was sugar. Now, Fidel Castro led this uprising, but as I said, he did not carry this forward to carry out a break with this situation in which sugar was the linchpin, the king of the economy, if you will. And whereas before, the U.S. was the dominant economic power, and sugar was being sold to the United States, and this was how the economy was structured, Castro was looking for a quick fix. Rather than carrying out an all-around economic transformation to break that dependency on the world market, to diversify agriculture, to make it possible for Cuba to meet its own food needs, Castro elected go with sugar. And instead of the U.S. now being the main recipient of sugar and its main customer, Castro looked to the Soviet Union, which called itself socialist but was not socialist. In the mid-1950s, capitalism was restored in the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union became a social imperialist power, of an imperial power that had a socialist cover. And Castro looked to the Soviet Union to play this kind of, if I might use the phrase, sugar daddy role, that is, to purchase sugar. And with the revenues from that sugar, Castro was able to pump funds into certain social programs. They also received from the Soviet Union oil at low prices, which they then resold on the world market. And this was the arrangement, the economic arrangement that Castro entered into. And as I said, it didn't fundamentally and radically alter the dependency of the Cuban economy and Cuban society on the world market. It was still beholden to sugar, and everything was structured around sugar, around more sugar production. Produce, raise the amount of tonnage that could be yielded in any year. And this was the logic that Castro enacted from the standpoint of, well, we're going to use those revenues to transform society. No, it didn't transform society, nor did the revolutionary leadership, as he described themselves, as the leaders described themselves, did they launch a social revolution. In other words, there was not the economic restructuring in terms of agriculture and creating a self-reliant, sustainable agriculture that could feed the people and carry out a step-by-step program of developing industry that could serve that kind of diverse and integrated agriculture, nor was there a genuine social revolution that was aimed at really digging up the oppressive relations, patriarchy, the profound inequalities between men and women. These things did not happen, battling racism. This was not a genuine revolution on the social front either. So the critique in the article, and this is the critique that Mao and the Chinese revolutionaries were making of Cuba, was that they were not breaking the grip of imperialism on the one hand, nor are they launching a genuine social revolution on the other. They were looking for a quick fix. So rather than the United States being the key market and the key source of credit and subsidies, now the Soviet Union, which was no longer socialist, took that place and played that role. Even with this, Cuba remained a thorn in the side of U.S. imperialism.
That's exactly where I wanted to go, actually, because that was the point, too, is that, you know, I was thinking that as you're talking about, even with all that, and maybe in some ways, even because of its linking up with the Soviet Union, this whole point of there was just an endless series of attempts to overthrow Castro, to poison him, to kill him, the Bay of Pigs invasion, and the whole, like, armada of nukes that were just pointed at Cuba in the 1960s. You know, let's talk about that a little bit. And then that also raises a question is, well, what the hell has happened? What's changed now that suddenly the U.S. can make this sort of new approach to Cuba?
Well, so now we're moving the story forward. We began with the period of Spanish rule, and then the U.S. moves in. Then in 1959, the Cuban Revolution takes place, and Cuba becomes integrated into the Soviet imperial bloc. And now most of its trade is conducted with the Soviet Union and with Eastern Europe. And as I said, even though this was not a radical transformation of society, of economic relations, of the culture, it was still an obstacle to U.S. plans in the Western Hemisphere and internationally. Castro remained a vocal critic of U.S. imperialism. He gave support to anti-imperialist movements in the Western Hemisphere. And he did not buckle under to U.S. threats and pressures to sort of hang it up and to sort of surrender to U.S. imperialism. So the U.S. was not reconciled to its defeat, you know, by the Cuban Revolution, to its lost paradise being taken over, and never relented in its efforts to undermine this revolution. And you yourself, as you asked the question, indicated some of the things. There was the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. This was a CIA-financed, backed, and orchestrated invasion of Cuba by Cuban exiles in 1961. And the purpose of this was to overthrow Castro and to install a government that would be friendly and supine to the United States. Well, that invasion was defeated by the Cuban people. There were the assassination attempts, and the U.S. employed, you know, we keep coming back to the mobsters and the mafia and the gangsters, and made use of gangsters and mafia to carry out assassination attempts. And there was the imposition of this embargo. And the embargo is a term. It means preventing Cuba. This was imposed by the United States. It was imposed by the United States and enforced by the U.S. Navy, and this was to prevent trade between Cuba and other countries. The U.S. cut off economic relations, and it put pressure on Latin American countries to cease carrying out trade, and also put pressure on the West European countries. This was in the 1960s and 1970s through the 1980s. So these were the ways, militarily, through attempts at assassination, through sabotage, through terrorist acts, and through economic pressure, that the U.S. was constantly working to undermine this regime and to topple it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Raymond Latta. Raymond's a political economist, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and an advocate of Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism. So what is it that's changed? This is a big question for people.
When we carry this history forward, as I mentioned, Cuba did not carry out an all-around revolution. And as a result, it was not a radical transformation of the economy. It wasn't a radical transformation of social relations. And Cuba became ever more dependent on the Soviet Union for subsidies, for support. And in exchange for that, as I said, Cuba was able to import food by selling oil that it got from the Soviet Union on the world market. It was able to sell its sugar to the Soviet Union at subsidized prices. So this was the arrangement. But the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989, and this set off tremors in the Cuban economy precisely because it was so beholden to those commercial and economic arrangements. So the gross domestic product, you know, just plummeted by 35% in the early 90s. It wasn't able to import goods anymore in the same way that it had before. And Cuba entered into an extended period of economic crisis. So the Cuban leadership, again, applying that outlook of looking for quick fixes, no longer had the Soviet Union as the source of credit, as the source of economic assistance, as the market that would be reliable for it. So what you have is another attempt at a quick fix, and here the Cuban leadership looks to moving away from sugar towards tourism, and it invites in foreign investment. And we see foreign investors coming into certain spheres of Cuba. And then with tourism growing and the hotel industry growing, and I'm talking about in the mid and late 1990s, you begin to see the reappearance of social evils like prostitution. So this is what's happening. But the economy is entering into this very, very serious crisis. And Cuba now doesn't have the Soviet Union, but it looks in the early 2000s to the Venezuela. Venezuela is providing it with oil at discounted prices, and with that oil, it's able to continue to function economically. And Cuba is offsetting the discounted price of oil with credits that it's obtaining from China and other capitalist and imperialist countries. And Cuba is also sending doctors to Venezuela. This is the arrangement. But now Venezuela is entering into crisis with the collapse of world oil prices. And this is putting additional pressure, new sources of pressure on Cuba. So the backdrop for this move by the United States is twofold. One, the Cuban economy is in serious crisis, and the leadership in Cuba is looking to wheel and deal now with the United States. And the leadership is also looking to hold on, so it wants to stabilize. And this is one means and measure by which it can do it. Then there's the question of what the U.S. is motivated by, why the U.S. is undertaking this shift in its stance and its posture towards Cuba. And this, as I said, is not driven by some newfound respect for the sovereignty of Cuba or Obama suddenly waking up and saying, aha, we have to treat them as equals and that our old policies didn't work. They say their old policies didn't work, but what they are actually doing is implementing a new set of policies which are aimed at achieving regime change, but this time the regime change is from within. That is, by penetrating Cuba economically, politically, socially, through the media, through the internet, through the hotel industry once anew, and putting pressure from within. This is what is economically motivating and politically motivating the U.S., and I also bring into the picture a larger geostrategic component. And this is very critical, Michael. And by that, I'm referring to the fact that since the early 2000s, the U.S. has been focused in its war for greater empire, its war on the world that goes by the name of the war on terrorism. And the focus of those efforts have militarily been in the Middle East and in Central Asia. And that's been the focus of U.S. foreign policy. And it was not paying, the U.S. imperialists were not paying as much attention to Latin America. And in this period of the 2000s into the new decade that we're in, China was very quietly and very steadily increasing its influence in the Western Hemisphere, in South America, in Latin America. China has emerged as the second largest foreign investor in South America. It is the largest trading partner of Brazil, which is the largest economy in Latin America. So China has been emerging as an economic rival to the United States in its own hemisphere, the Western Hemisphere, and it regards Latin America, the U.S. does, arrogantly as its backyard. And here China is gaining strength. And you have Venezuela asserting its foreign policy in the 2000s, which was another thorn in the side of U.S. imperialism. So this geopolitical situation is of concern to U.S. imperialism, the growing economic strength of China, and a lot of China's investments are focused in raw materials and in what's called infrastructure, building roads and dams, and it is constructing a new canal. It's now entered into agreement with Nicaragua to construct a canal that will be longer and deeper than the Panama Canal. So this is what's driving U.S. imperialism to look at its relationship with Cuba in a different way. That is, to enter into these more normalized relations in order to achieve regime change from within, as I say, and to integrate Cuba into its imperial network as a way of reasserting its influence and hegemony, that is, its dominant position in the Western Hemisphere.
All right. Now, Raymond, we have about 5 minutes, but I really don't want to leave without speaking to the point that you made in your piece about actually what Cuba needs is a real revolution. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I'm saying is I've painted a picture of Cuba as a society that was not able, under the leadership of Castro, under that leadership, to affect the kind of revolution that is needed in Cuba and in today's world. And what I'm drawing on in this analysis is what Bob Avakian has described as three alternative worlds. And people can look at that article at revcom.us. And I think it's very helpful, this essay by Avakian, Three Alternative Worlds, to sort out and understand what are the challenges before us today. The first alternative, he says, is to leave the world the way it is, with all its wars for empire, the destruction of the environment, the brutalization and degradation of women. That is not acceptable. We don't want to live in this kind of world. The second alternative is to put some band-aids on certain economic and social inequities. This is what happened in Cuba, and it's really just a variation on leaving the world as it is. What the world needs is a truly emancipatory alternative, a genuine communist revolution, what Marx called the two radical ruptures, to rupture with traditional property relations, with all forms of exploitation, and with traditional ideas, with all that enslaves and imprisons people, all oppression. And this is the revolution that is needed to uproot all exploitation, to overcome all oppressive relations, the deep-seated inequalities between men and women, the fact that there is a profound divide between mental and manual labor, between those who labor with their hands and those who are able to work in the realm of ideas, to be able to empower the masses of people to make decisions over the basic direction of society, to have a society in which intellectual life, intellectual ferment and dissent are not only tolerated but are welcomed and fostered. This is the kind of society where people are being empowered. The vast majority are being empowered to ever more consciously change themselves and change society in the interest of emancipating humanity. This is the revolution that's needed, and it is a monumental challenge. It is complex to make this kind of revolution in today's world, and it requires visionary vanguard leadership basing itself on a scientific understanding of reality and how society and the world can be transformed. But this is possible, and this is what Avakian has brought forward, a framework and understanding, a strategy to do this, because there are these challenges. There's the globalization of the world economy, the environmental crisis, and the threats of imperialist intervention, attack, and encirclement when revolution does break through. But this is possible. This revolution is what's needed. It is viable, and it is the only alternative to the badness and horror of today's world.
Raymond Lada, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, and hopefully we can talk more about this and other issues.
Absolutely, man. Look forward to it. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Raymond Lada, political economist and writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we've been talking about the U.S. and Cuba, and specifically about Raymond's piece, Recolonization in the Name of Normalization, Behind the Reestablishment of U.S.-Cuba Diplomatic Relations. You can find this article on the site revcom.us, and you can also find a lot of other things on there that would really help you understand the world and get involved in changing the world. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Werewolves on Wheels, and I couldn't resist playing that one, all right? And it's from a collection of cult movie classics, and it's by Don Gear, all right? I think that's how you say the name, but Werewolves on Wheels. The concept just drove me a little crazy, so I wanted you to hear that. All right, and that fits in perfectly with this segment, all right? Because we're going to be talking about films, the progressive films, the films that are out there, the award season, and we're going to be talking about all this with revolutionary film critic Ed Rampell, and Ed's work appears in many publications, and in particular in the Progressive magazine. Ed, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you again, Michael.
Let's jump into it, because we have not as much time as I would like, but enough time to really dig into some things. You know, you sent me the nominees for the Progy Awards this year, and I was really, really, I was moved by them. I also realized how many films I hadn't seen. I was glad to see some of the films that I really loved included in there. But I also, this morning, I woke up and found that the nominees for the Oscar Awards were out today. And I really have to say, there's such a stark contrast between what was, seems to have been going on with the Oscars and the Progy Awards. What's your hit on the Oscars?
Well, first of all, I do think that they're overlooking, as is often the case, independent films and more socially conscious movies with a conscience, such as Dear White People, is completely missing, I believe, from the Oscars. I think also the South American movie The Liberator about Simon Bolivar, starring Edgar Ramirez. This is a Venezuelan film that is nowhere to be seen in the Oscars, I believe. The movie Cesar Chavez about union organizing, which had a really great performance by America Ferrera as Helen Chavez. I believe that's completely missing in action from the Oscars, just totally overlooked. It was directed by a Mexican filmmaker, and that movie, Cesar Chavez, is nominated for the Progy for the Trumbo Award, which is the Best Progressive Picture, and America Ferrera is also nominated for the Best Actress Award, Best Progressive Actress. So there are very big differences. The Godard film, Goodbye to Language, is nominated for at least two Progies, including the Trumbo Best Progressive Picture, and also the Guillo, after Guillo Pontecorvo, for Best Foreign Film. I don't think that that's anywhere to be seen on the Oscars. Mm-hmm. Now, 2 Days, One Night, about a woman's battle against unemployment, is... Marion Cotillard did, justifiably so, receive an Oscar nomination. She's also nominated for the Progy for Best Progressive Actress, but the movie, the Belgian film, 2 Days, One Night, is actually also nominated for the Trumbo Award for the Best Progressive Picture of the Year.
We're going to get into a lot of that, Ed, in a couple minutes. But, you know, as I'm listening to you, I also wanted to remind people, I wanted to let people know, because I don't know, you know, it's always good to make sure people know what we're actually talking about here. And the Progy Awards, I want you to explain them. It's something that happens every year since, what, 2007, and it's sponsored by the organization that actually is involved in the Progy Awards and presenting the Progy Awards is the James Agee Cinema Circle. So give us a little bit of background on the Progies, what they are.
Sure. The Progies is kind of a short, catchy way to say progressive. You know, it's a showbiz way to say progressive. So the Progy Awards are nominated annually by an international group of left-leaning film critics, reviewers, film historians, cinema scholars, etc. And the criterion is based on the social consciousness and conscience of the films. Now, that is in terms of the content, but also the form, Godard being a good example of stretching the boundaries of film form. So they differ from the Academy Awards, the Golden Globes, which purportedly aim to vote for excellence in an artistic sense. And of course, we know that there are a lot of commercial considerations often as well. Whereas the Progies have no commercial consideration, and artistic excellence is not really the sole qualification. The progressive content of the film, are they pro-working class, pro-minority rights, pro-women's rights, pro-LGBT, pro-environment, anti-climate change, and so on. Those are the criterions, whether or not a film is anti-war, whether a film is supporting the people. Those are the main criterions, and what we're trying to do is to highlight these films that are often overlooked by the motion picture establishment.
Well, let's jump into a couple of them, because there's some that I was really, really intrigued by you guys nominating them. And one of the things that actually, one of the films that I saw at Sundance last year, and I was really just slammed in the head with it. It was funny, it was searing, you walked out of it laughing, but also, wow, there's a whole lot of truth here. And it's the one you just mentioned, Dear White People. And there's a lot that this, you know, you talk about in the press release for the Progi nominations, you talk about the thematic questions going on here, and that the themes that were revealed by the nominations this year is the ongoing rise of films by and about people of color. And I wanted to talk a little bit about your hit on Dear White People, because I loved that film, and that was so sharp and so revealing in a time when it really needs to be, when you think about what's unfolded since then.
Right. Now, Dear White People is nominated in the Best Progressive Actress category. Tessa Thompson, who plays the lead character, and it's very rare to see a lead female protagonist in a film where there aren't like four other female stars in order to try to attract the box office. And it's also nominated for the Paul Robeson Award, which honors the best portrayal of people of color. And Dear White People was really funny, and it had some really searing and serious things beneath the humor to say about racism in America, asking the question whether or not we're really living in a post-racial society now that we have a black president. Tessa Thompson is great as the protagonist, and one could also say it was very timely because it came out right around the time of the Ferguson incidents is when it was theatrically released. Of course, you and I saw it at film festivals, but that was one of the best films of the year, and I think it's just like completely overlooked by the Academy.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with radical revolutionary film critic Ed Rampell, and he's from the James Agee Cinema Circle, and we're talking about the Progi nominations that were just released. You know, one of the things I was thinking about in relation to that, too, is that there's a number of films that actually are seem to be so, you know, they're just so right on point now, and they are. They are overlooked in general in award ceremonies. I mean, and you know, it's interesting because Selma got a nod for, what, for Best Picture, but then Ava DuVernay didn't get, you know, anything for Best Director or any of this. But there was this kind of sense of there's two different, just almost two different worlds going on here. And, you know, there's important films that have been shown that, you know, mainstream films that have come out this year. One that has been actually nominated for a Progi is Laura Poitras's film, Edward Snowden film, Citizen Four. And I wanted to talk about that because that's another thing that really stands up and just sort of jacks things up into the world.
Well, I do have to say that film is deservedly so also up for the Oscar nomination for Best Documentary, as well as being up for the Giga Progressive Award, mm-hmm. which is named after the great Soviet documentarian Giga Vertov. So in both the Progies and the Academy Awards, Laura Poitras's film is being recognized. I have to say that, as I have been predicting, in the documentary category of the Oscars, not in the Progies, but in the Oscars, you have a classic left-right contest. And Rory Kennedy's despicable, remarkably one-sided mockumentary, Last Days in Vietnam, which is trying to put the turd on the blossom of U.S. imperialism in Vietnam as the 40th anniversary of the liberation approaches, is also up for the Oscar, up against Laura Poitras's Citizen Four movie. And, Michael, do you remember that I saw you a few years ago on the streets of Hollywood Boulevard along with those other people protesting against Zero Dark Thirty getting Oscars?
Yeah, I remember that.
I believe that people should be raising awareness with the Academy voters not to vote for this remarkably, incredibly one-sided film that throughout the entire movie, Kennedy never once shows the point of view of the quote-unquote North Vietnamese or the Viet Cong, the National Liberation Front. Not one of them is ever interviewed. It's all U.S. servicemen and the South Vietnamese who cooperated with them. And this does a tremendous disservice, and it's a very dangerous movie because Vietnam is probably, arguably, the most hated war in American history. A lot of great movies came out of it, but the war itself was like really hated by millions and millions of Americans. And Rory Kennedy's film is trying to make it look like something that the U.S. imperialists did something good in Vietnam at a time when U.S. intervention around the world is increasing. Mm-hmm. And the specter of militarism is there. It's a very dangerous movie. We should remember who Rory Kennedy is. Her uncle raised the number of quote-unquote U.S. advisors in Vietnam from 600 to 16,000, according to CNN, when JFK was president. And one can't help but wonder, well, is she trying to burnish the image of her uncle's legacy, or what's going on there? But this is a very dangerous movie, mm-hmm. Last Days in Vietnam. I am not saying it should be censored. I am not saying to save the picture, you have to burn the picture. but I am saying that people should be aware of this film. People should make the Academy voters conscious about this film. And when it is screened by PBS on American Experience, shortly before the 40th anniversary of the liberation, by the way, it's going to be shown in America. The James Agee Cinema Circle has, as a group, asked PBS to, if they have to show it in a double feature with Oliver Stone's Platoon or Born on the 4th of July or Hearts and Mind. You know, one of the classic anti-Vietnam War movies. Mm-hmm. Very dangerous movie, awful movie, one-sided in a way that makes Michael Moore's movies look like the most balanced and fair documentaries ever made.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with radical revolutionary film critic Ed Rampell, and he's from the James Agee Cinema Circle, and we're talking about the Progy nominations that were just released. And Ed, there's a couple other films I want to talk about, and we have limited time, so I just want to jump into this, because thematically there's an element of human relations in this, the relationships between people, and people confronted with choices and with the compulsion to do something or to not do something. And I thought it was really, really interesting in terms of the films that, the two of the films that got picked for that. One was 2 Days, 2 Nights, and The other was Snowpiercer, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, let's talk about 2 Days, 1 Night, which stars Marion Cotillard, a French actress who won the Academy Award a few years ago for playing the real-life chanteuse or singer Edith Piaf. And in 2 Days, 1 Night, she portrays a Belgian working-class woman who is faced with losing her job at her factory. Now, stop and think about it. How many Hollywood movies deal with this kind of subject matter? When you have all these superhero and action-packed, violent blockbuster movies dealing with invasions of aliens from outer space and all this kind of stuff, this movie, 2 Days, 1 Night, deals with real problems of real, ordinary people. And one of the things that Marion Cotillard's character is battling is depression. And, you know, depression has a dual meaning. It could be economic or it could be psychological. And what I really thought was insightful in this film by the Dardenne brothers is that if you watch it closely, Michael, her mood swings go up and down depending on whether her co-workers are showing her solidarity. And this really puts its finger on a very important problem at this time of an ebb in the international proletarian movement, in the international union movement, the workers' movement, etc., when the whole issue of workers sticking together, and when they don't stick together, how it could psychologically affect people in capitalist society. So this film is up for the Trumbo, the best progressive picture, and she, Marion Cotillard, is up deservedly so for an Oscar, and deservedly so for the Progy for best progressive actress. And I hope she wins both.
In terms of this way of how people relate to one another, the point there a lot of times comes down to, will her fellow workers actually go for what's in it for me, or will they rise to the occasion? And it's not just a question of solidarity, but there's a real moral dilemma, and there's a real thing that I think faces so much of humanity these days. Are you going to do the right thing, or are you going to, you know, just stick your nose in the trough and slobber it as much up as you can? And I think actually that brings me to this film, Kill the Messenger, which I think when we were talking about Laura Poitras's film, the other film that comes out that I don't think it got anywhere near the respect that it deserved and the exposure that it deserved in terms of the, you know, its mainstream release. But Kill the Messenger is a very heavy film, I think, and I was really glad to see this get nominated by the James Agee Cinema Circle.
Yeah, Jeremy Renner is up for the Garfield Award, named after the great actor John Garfield, for portraying Gary Webb. Now, I actually met Gary Webb in Hawaii, so I was personally delighted that this film and Renner did get a nomination. And for people who don't remember, Gary Webb was this crusading journalist in the best sense of the term crusading, in the sense that he was on a moral mission to expose the CIA and the Contra network in Central America and the drug running that was bringing drugs from Central America into, in particular, the African-American communities. And then I think the proceeds from these sales was going back to arm these butcherers, the Contras, as part of mass murderer Reagan's Contra war in Central America. So Gary Webb documented this. And instead of Gary Webb being feted, celebrated by his colleagues, many in the mainstream corporate bourgeois press turned on him. And the film shows the toll that it took on him. Once again, the lack of solidarity, especially from your peers, from your colleagues, from your coworkers, the toll it can take on the human spirit.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know what? I'm going to give you a minute to comment on a film we saw together, and I loved your review of it, Goodbye to Language, because that's also nominated for a Progy. And I know we can't get into a big thing about it, and I wouldn't want to because I'm still sorting it out. I'm doing it chunk by chunk. So,
well, this is by Jean-Luc Godard, and I have to admit that when I watched it, I had no idea what it was about. It was completely indecipherable to me, and yet I liked it. The imagery is gorgeous. It's Godard's 43rd movie, but his first one in 3D. He's about 84 years old now and lives in Switzerland. And even though I had no idea what was happening, there's a lot of shots of a dog. There's the usual graphic nudity that you'll see in a Godard movie, including the dog who's naked all the time. And you know that dog, he did speak a pretty good French, by the way. Although he barked in a canine accent.
Right.
But I liked it. I have no idea what it's about. But sometimes I think that you should see a film not just with the head, so to speak, but with the heart. And we have a Progy category that is called the Bunuel Award, which kind of is more oriented towards film form, and Birdman is nominated in that category. Mm-hmm. Goodbye to Language is actually nominated for the best progressive foreign film, and it's also nominated for the best progressive picture, the Progy. So Jean-Luc Godard, who made a lot of leftist films during the 60s and the 70s, one of the new wave pioneer filmmakers, still making movies at 84 years old.
Right. All right, Ed. And on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up. But I want you, you're going to come back when the winners of the Progies are announced, and we'll have you back, and we'll dig into all this a whole lot more. And also, we'll be back talking about the Oscars when they're announced as well. All right, Ed?
I look forward to it, Michael.
All right, Ed. Take care. Thanks a lot, man.
Bye.
Bye. Now, before we go out, I want to go back to something that we were talking about in the first part of the show, Cuba and its relationship with the U.S. over the years, and what that says about the U.S. and the world and us in terms of what we do. So I wanted to read this to you. It's from Bob Avakian in his book, Basics. If you can conceive of a world without America, without everything that America stands for and everything it does in the world, then you've already taken great strides and begun to get at least a glimpse of a whole new world. If you can envision a world without any imperialism, exploitation, oppression, and the whole philosophy that rationalizes it, a world without division into classes or even different nations, and all the narrow-minded, selfish, outmoded ideas that uphold this, if you can envision all this, then you have the basis for proletarian internationalism. And once you have raised your sights to all this, how could you not feel compelled to take an active part in the world historic struggle to realize it? Why would you want to lower your sights to anything less? And that's from Bob Avakian's book, Basics. And it is the chapter 1, 31st quote in the book. And you can get Basics as an ebook by going to the site revcom.us. All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with film critic Ed Rampell about the Progy Awards, and we're going to have Ed back as the Oscars and the Progies themselves actually get awarded and the Oscars shape up, so stay tuned for that. He'll be joining us again in the near future. Well, that just about brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Raymond Latta and Ed Rampell. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And we're going to go out now with a song that I think captures the spirit of the show today and the spirit of what we need in the world. All right, it's called Fighting Song, Future Rock from Outer National. Check this out.
Shore or a choice. Sometimes it's like I'm without a home. Last night I walked 1,000 miles alone. I walked and wandered, posed and pondered, and these times I can't live like this any longer. The well is running dry as the ocean's rising.